This is KVNF. It's time for Local Motion. I'm Gavin Dahl. Today, two new interviews jam-packed with information. We start with Carlton Mason, CEO for CASA of the 7th Judicial District, a nonprofit serving Delta, Gunnison, Hinsdale, Montrose, Ouray, and San Miguel counties. Court-appointed special advocates are helping to break the cycle of child abuse and neglect through prevention, advocacy, and interaction. Then citizen reporter Joanne Kalanak of the nonprofit Delta County Citizen Report talks about a long list of subjects, including government transparency, the mask mandate, recycling, junkyards, and code enforcement. Stay tuned. Carlton Mason is CEO for CASA of the 7th Judicial District. Thanks for joining me on KVNF.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
For folks who don't know, what is CASA's mission and what are your program areas?
We're court-appointed special advocates. That right now is currently the moniker over the door, the name that we identify by. And it is one of our program areas, and it is court-appointed special advocates. These are community members who work with kids who have experienced abuse and neglect in the home, and we work closely with the courts and with the child welfare and just try to provide a stable presence for these kids going through that experience. Most are in foster care and have those challenges that go along with that circumstance. The other two areas that we work across the six counties of the 7th Judicial District are supervised visitation, and that's where we provide non-custodial parents a place where it's supervised and they can meet with their kids. Last year, we did nearly 6,000 supervised visits here in the 7th Judicial District, most of those taking place in Montrose and Delta. That's almost 7,000 hours of supervised visitation time. And it's an important part of maintaining family relationships and providing an opportunity to get these families hopefully back together. The third area that we work with a lot, and that's probably been the most growing area here in the last few years, and that is our youth services. And that ranges from walk-in youth here at the Youth Access Center in Montrose. These are kids, maybe parents are at work, maybe they don't have strong family support systems. They can come in and just provide a safe place where they begin to get access to help, whether it's educational goals or employment, or sometimes it's just IDs, sometimes just a safe support group here in our facility. Out of that, we have also started housing. And 2 years ago, we opened up First Place on 2nd Street here in Montrose, and we will be doing that again in Delta soon. Those are the three areas.
So this housing community for 18 to 24-year-olds who age out of foster care in Montrose, talk about that need that you've been addressing here.
A number of years ago, the county asked us to provide life skills training for youth coming out of foster care. These were kids that were 14 and a half or older and likely to emancipate out of the system. We did that, and our outcomes were not that great. In 2017, we saw 10 of these young people come out of our system, and within a year, we couldn't find them. We had news that one had trafficked herself back to New Mexico. They were experiencing homelessness. And we also saw as a community that homelessness was an issue. And we came across the data that 50% of our kids that come out of foster care experience homelessness within 2 years. And we realized this was a problem that was kind of in our area. These were our kids. You know, this was within our mission as an organization to help these young people. And that's how we got into the housing.
And so let me ask you about the evidence of your efficacy. CASA has an interesting way you calculate the savings to the community based on the services you provide. Can you talk about some of those numbers, Carlton?
Yeah, there's a lot around that. And let me give you the broader picture. So here we are, we build housing, and it's subsidized by the state and local donors, and we put together this $1.2 million project. And the kids move in on what is called a state-funded supported housing voucher. And we provide services around life skills, employment, education, mental health. But we still have to ask ourselves, if this young person is in public-funded housing at the age of 40, did we help this situation, or did we create a system or a dynamic where it was actually hard to get back out of? In other words, it just became a lifestyle. And for some, that will be a necessity. It's the nature of it. But for others, at 18 years old, they still had hopes and aspirations, and we wanted to make sure they met those dreams. We also wanted to make sure that, you know, was there a way to know that we were actually creating a benefit or a savings? So we contracted with a private consultant out of Boulder named Mission Launch. And we went to her and said, look, here's the national outcomes for kids coming out of foster care. Going to experience homelessness at this rate. They're going to have criminal charges at, you know, this percentage in this amount of time. Emergency room visits, educational outcomes. And we said, can you go through the research and identify the cost associated with those outcomes? If we could reduce the number of emergency room visits, what's the savings to the community? If we can reduce the nights of homelessness or emergency shelter, what could that save a community based on, you know, cost averages? If we can improve educational outcomes, like I think it's 2% of foster kids end up with a college education. Can we improve that? Can we make sure they finish high school? She went through all those areas, and we created a calculator that we can go ahead and enter in our data each year that says, out of, let's look at 2020, okay? In 2020, we provided 148 months of supportive housing. What I mean by that was, is we had a total of, at any given time, you know, we averaged about 11, 12 kids. And then, of course, some would move out, some would move back in, some stayed there. We still have kids that have been there for 2 years. But we provided 148 months of supportive housing. That reduces the need for emergency shelter for an estimated community savings. If you look right now in Colorado, it's estimated that emergency shelter is costing somewhere just over $30,000 a year. We took our numbers, this was a couple years ago, tried to make them as safe as we could. And I think it was around $23,000 or $27,000 a year to a community if they have to provide emergency shelter. That goes into food, that goes into probably some of the law enforcement involvement, social service involvement, case management. In 2020, we estimated our savings to be somewhere around $325,000 just by reducing the need for emergency shelter.
Mm-hmm.
We achieved a 77% reduction in emergency room visits. That savings was around $14,000, just under $15,000. We reduced the number of criminal charges to zero for the young people in our buildings for a savings of $147,000. You look at the increase of employment rate. At one point during the middle of COVID, we had over 70% of our youth employed. This is for a demographic that might hit 20 to 30%. So in 2020, we look at our community savings of around $570,000. And we have really tried to make sure those are safe numbers, but those are numbers that include, for instance, if we don't have a criminal charge, how much time are we reducing in the court system, in our law enforcement systems? If we reduce those emergency room visits, what are we saving? You know, what's an emergency room visit cost? If we can cut that back. So that's kind of how we came to those numbers. And in the first 2 years, by looking at some just these simple numbers around these five data points, our return on investment was over 90%. In other words, our savings to the community was well over $1 million.
My guest is Carlton Mason, CEO for CASA of the 7th Judicial District. Last month, your youth services program broke ground on a new facility in Delta. You've raised the money with local funds and grants. Tell us about First Place on Palmer Street.
Kind of a different model than we did here in Montrose. We're going to try more of a shared community space. So we have on the ground floor four what are called zero-bedroom suites. They will have vouchers with them that are provided by the state of Colorado. These allow the kids to get in there, to stabilize, to provide a warm, safe place. Each of these single-bedroom units have their own bathroom, their own shower, their own little kitchenette. But we really believe that a sense of community is important for achieving long-term stabilization and growth for these young people. So we're going to try it a little different. It'll have that shared living space. Upstairs we have like a two-bedroom apartment that will also provide living quarters for two more young adults that are 18 to 24 and in need of supportive services. So we will have staff that will be in the building every day trying to help with mental health needs, employment, social skills, just a host of services that traditionally kids get just by growing up in a home, in a family.
Before we go, I want to ask you about a proposal here in the state of Colorado to allow foster youth who leave the system as teens to return until age 21. According to the Colorado Sun, of foster kids who leave the system to live on their own, only about 1/4 graduate from high school on time, about 1/3 have kids of their own, and about 1/3 end up homeless within 3 years. It sounds like the proposal from the State Child Welfare Division is awaiting approval from state lawmakers in the form of House Bill 1094. What's your take on this briefly, Carlton?
We support the bill. I do know, as we've worked with partners across the state, that we have heard some concerns on both sides of the bill, and I think they're valid. But as an organization, we support that opportunity for our young people to come back into the system.
Thanks so much for taking some time to speak with KVNF, and look forward to talking to you more, as there's so much to talk about.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
Our next guest on Local Motion this week is Joanne Kalanak from the local nonprofit Delta County Citizens Report. Thanks for joining me, Joanne.
Pleasure, Gavin. Glad to be here.
We'll talk about the mask mandate, recycling referred to as an entitlement, code enforcement in the county, and more. First, how long have you been a resident of the North Fork Valley, and what is DCCR all about?
I've lived in the North Fork for almost 20 years. My husband and I moved here in 2002. DCCR was started in November of 2016 and to kind of address what I felt was the division that is so obvious and poignant in our country. And it really came down to partisan politics and non-participation by citizens. So I figured, okay, I've been in the publishing business for 40 years. I know a little bit about county government, so why not combine the two and just become a citizen reporter and let the people know what was going on locally with our local government.
Well, let me ask you about ongoing concerns with government transparency in Delta County. I started at KVNF last summer. Right away, I found attending public meetings via Zoom confusing before getting to know the voices of the commissioners. All members of the public, not just the press, often can't actually see commissioners on camera, and the audio quality is variable at best. Head honcho Robbie LaValle told KVNF that the county's new video equipment is backordered. That was a couple months ago. In the meantime, Sunshine Week came and went. What has been your experience during the pandemic attempting to stay connected to the public business of the county as a blogger?
Well, first, I really appreciate the ability to have attended the meetings virtually, even if they were, for the most part, audio-based. It's nice not to have to make that 40-minute one-way drive. But it's been very puzzling that video although they started out with some video, that they kind of they stopped doing video early on, and we were relegated to just hearing their voices. And today's meeting, today I was at a work session. I actually did have to drive to come to this work session because the commissioners have decided not to Zoom, to no longer offer free live streaming of work sessions. They are, I understand that they are committed to live streaming the business meetings, those public business meetings, but they are having issues with their notifications. And today at the commissioner's meeting, the county clerk actually acknowledged those problems and said that she was working on notification. We were all getting notified that a meeting was about to occur and you or was going to occur in a 24-hour period, and that you could attend virtually, you could register virtually. So to me, that's a big step backwards. We've had issues for a long time. And the pandemic, to me, actually opened up a new world of transparency for government, and to see them step back and no longer Zoom those work sessions is real disappointing.
Well, thank you for attending and making a Zoom available. I was able to tune in just for a few minutes to the work session Tuesday afternoon and heard a claim that China is simply dumping recycling in the ocean. Let's talk recycling in Delta County. Last month, the county put out a request for proposals for a new recycling contractor. Today, April 6th, the commissioners had a work session to look into that. How did it go?
Actually, I was surprised. In some ways, I was shocked. Since we haven't really, the public hasn't really been involved in earlier work sessions, I haven't seen any notices. They certainly haven't talked about recycling in a public business meeting. The only news I've been able to get on recycling has been reported by Lisa Young and the DCI. So I kind of came in when they put out the RFP, which is a request for proposals, asking for private contractors to bid to take over the project. Okay, my first thought was, all right, they're going to just dump this whole thing on a private contractor, and that contractor is going to then charge the public to take recycling. Lo and behold, a deeper look into that RFP was that they were looking for a recycler who would offer free recycling to the public. And the proposal came in today, and although they didn't name them specifically, Double J came up a couple of times, so I'm assuming it's Double J who was the only bidder. And they came up with a $125,000 quote that they would charge the county. So the county would pay them $125,000 a year to provide free recycling to Delta County residents. I was surprised by that, pleasantly so.
Well, you've written about wondering if county commissioners were having discussions outside of public meetings about making changes to the North Fork Transfer Station and Recycling Center. When Delta County Independent reporter Lisa Young asked Commissioner Supas about this in January, she writes, "In response to criticism that county officials have not properly informed North Fork residents on why the changes are warranted, Commissioner Supas said, quote, it was time to revisit the recycling portion of the transfer station. As we looked at it, we realized two things. One, we're competing with the private sector. There are plenty of people doing curbside pickup. There's the recycling center in Austin. And second, the taxpayers are providing a subsidized entitlement, basically for a small portion of the community." That sounded like an assertion of an opinion and maybe a bit of a dodge about whether or not there has been a public process. But talk about the claim today that recycling is an entitlement, a subsidized entitlement. Well, that seemed to be the flavor of the conversation in the commissioner's work session.
I'd say absolutely. If there was an objection at all, it came from Commissioner Supas. We really didn't hear too much from Commissioners Lane or Kuntz, but Commissioner Supas reiterated his concern about the cost, the $125,000 cost. Again, citing it as essentially a subsidy.
Well, what do we know about the finances of the North Fork Transfer Station in terms of, you know, where things began at the outset of the 2021 budget year?
Well, what we do know is that the 9-year pilot program, which is kind of funny right there, is a, as Robbie LaValle put it in the work session, has been a great success. Now, why? It's been a great success because it is the transfer station is not losing money. It has $53,000 in county reserve. It started the budget year with $53,000 in reserve, so obviously it's not losing money.
With the return to more in-person meetings, we know that wearing masks inside enclosed spaces isn't a thing for the current Delta County commissioners. In light of the governor loosening some aspects of the mask mandate last weekend and Delta County moving to level green on the state COVID dial in late March, what did staff report to the commissioners in the COVID update at this week's commissioner meeting?
Yeah, absolutely. The mask mandate is a big deal here for diametrically opposed reasons. Darnell reported to commissioners that while we were in green, status green, we no longer would need to wear masks. However, there is a caveat to that statewide mandate, and it revolves around how many active cases you have. We have 65 active cases, and I believe the state mandate is 35. At least that's what Darnell reported, that you have to be 35 or fewer, have 35 or fewer cases to not wear a mask.
Joanne, in your April 4th newsletter, you also talked about a bill up in the legislature introduced by a member of the House, Kathy Kipp, a Democrat from Fort Collins, and it specifies that members of a county or district board of health are not allowed to serve concurrently as members of a board of county commissioners and as members of a county or district board of health. The bill also allows members of a county or district board of health to be removed for malfeasance or other reasons. Remind listeners, what is going on with the Delta County Board of Health?
Boy, this is a great, this is one of my pet projects right now. House Bill 21-1115, I think is pretty important to the county, especially where public health is concerned. We have a 5-member Board of Health. 3 of those members are county commissioners. So it's politics is directing our public health. If it comes down to money, for example, the commissioners will have undue influence into investing money into public health, things like that. When you've got commissioners who clearly have an opinion about this pandemic as something, if we let's pretend it's not here and it'll just go away, and or that its economic impact is so great that we should pretend and not wear masks as they don't, I mean, these are the people that are making decisions on the Board of Health. It's a clear conflict, I think. I mean, it's politicized. This bill is hopefully going to pull politics out of public health.
My guest is Joanne Kalanak from Delta County Citizens Report. Her work is available on the DCCR Facebook page and via an email newsletter, which you can find at citizenreport.substack.com. I'd like to ask you, Joanne, about some of the other stories you've been covering in your newsletter the past couple of months. Back on March 6th, you wrote about the city of Delta looking to move the town's library. You were writing about what you witnessed at a joint work session of the Delta County Commissioners and City of Delta that took place, I believe, March 1st. What do we know?
Well, no decisions have been made. I want to stress that. But the county has been eyeing the Delta Public Library, the historic Delta Public Library, for some time in order to expand, to be able to expand the jail. Now, there's some confusion there. From what I understand, they don't want to put the jail at that location, the historic library. What they want to do is put administration. They want to put the sheriff's department, dispatch, and so on at that location. And at their current location, that would then free up space to expand the jail.
You've written about junkyards and illegal trailer parks in Delta County. What's the issue, and what is the county planning to do about it?
Well, all you need to do is drive around the county to see what the issue is.
Right.
Yeah, you go into the Dobies, you can see a myriad of places where there are multiple trailer homes, that just junked cars, trash, that kind of thing. Several meetings back, a gentleman from Cedar Ridge came in and commissioners meeting and pleaded with the commissioners at that time to please do something about what was happening in his neighborhood, that it was, he was very distressed that it was lowering his property values and so on. And what was happening is his neighbor was about to put in yet another trailer on a few acres and turning it into kind of an illegal, what he called trailer park. And then just down the road, there was another neighbor just piling up beat up cars, rusting cars, and that kind of thing. At that time, the commissioners reported that they would look in earnest for a code enforcement officer, which has been mandated by the new land use code that they just passed. So we're all kind of looking forward to having codes. A junk ordinance, we've had a junk ordinance for years. We just haven't had anybody to go out there and put their arms around it and enforce the code.
Yeah, I remember you wrote in your newsletter, when asked by commissioners whether he, the Cedar Edge resident, had filed a complaint with the county's planning department, the Cedar Edge resident said he had on several occasions, and you wrote, at one time was told, quote, we've seen worse. So it doesn't sound like enforcement was a thing, but maybe it will be soon. One more question here. In February, you mentioned in your newsletter that Delta County commissioners awarded a nearly $500,000 contract to Stryker and Company to remodel the county courthouse and expand the courtroom. The Montrose-based company built the new human services building for the county right behind the courthouse. Didn't the new human services building flood?
It did. It did. It had a pipe break.
Did that come up in discussions at a public meeting when the commissioners awarded the company another contract?
Actually, it did not. In fact, Commissioner Stupas, who seems to be the board member who heads all of Delta County's construction projects, he complimented Stryker quite profusely when he was recommending that the board accept the new bid.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That citizen reporter, Joanne Kalinak, from the nonprofit Delta County Citizens Report. Her work is available on the DCCR Facebook page and via her email newsletter, which you can find at citizenreport.substack.com. Thank you for your continued efforts to keep the residents of Delta County informed, and thanks for joining me on Local Motion.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure.